everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz.
I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Pulse.
And today we'll be continuing our reread of The Running Grave, covering chapters 71 through 74 of part 5. Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of The Running Grave will often reference the ending of this book, as well as the previous books in the series.
Before we start with the chapters today, I thought it would be really fun if we explored Sark a bit more. So we talked about theories of what could happen there, but not so much the place itself, the locations, the history. So I thought, let's dive a little bit deeper and see if we can find something that might connect with the hallmarked man.
Yeah.
It's going to take a little while before that rolls naturally off the tongue.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I thought was really nice was how some of the Sark Twitter accounts were so excited about the news of the header, and they were retweeting things.
I love it.
Yeah, one of those accounts was the Stocks Hotel. Their website says they're Sark's oldest hotel. I can't help but wonder if this place is going to make an appearance. Maybe Strike and Robin stay here.
Yes, please.
Has some exciting potential. I don't think we'll be getting only one bed again.
Unless we do, because they're already together.
Oh, okay. That would be amazing. But
probably not.
They do have some rooms that are more like apartments. So they have two bedrooms with a shared living space. That could be interesting.
And you know, it's so much easier to knock on someone else's bedroom door when it's just across the living room.
The tension would be good.
It would be amazing. I would love this, obviously. And you know, given how tricky it is to get to Sark with the multiple ferries or whatever, I think they'll absolutely be staying at least overnight, if not two nights.
Yeah.
A few chapters could be as many as five. And if they're long chapters, that's two nights in a day right there.
Maybe.
Maybe. It's possible.
So when I was looking into Sark, TripAdvisor has one of those articles, you know, 15 things to do in Sark. I thought we can go through some of these and see if any of them might pop up in the book.
Let's do it.
So obviously we have La Coupée.
I think we're pretty much guaranteed to see this, right?
Because
it's been on the header. I can imagine that if they have to walk over this, Strike is going to be pretty nervous.
I don't like it.
Well, you know, maybe if he's nervous, he can hold Robin's hand.
There you go.
I don't like heights.
Me neither.
Just looking at a picture of this kind of makes my knees shaky.
Interesting. I don't get that. I'm cool.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about it right now. I'm feeling like a little panicky.
It's a very wide road.
I read that children who used to cross it had to crawl because the winds were so bad sometimes.
Yeah, well, they're tiny. No wind is picking me up, I promise you that.
So the next thing is called the Avenue. This is a main street in Sark where you'd find shops, cafes, pubs.
Yeah.
I definitely think that this is plausible, like they'll go to one of the cafes or something.
There'll probably be more stuff open there than there are now, because apparently there have been a lot of shops that have closed down since COVID.
Oh, well, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so.
And then you have Sarkhenge. It's like a mini Stonehenge overlooking the sea.
Yeah. Built in 2015, though.
Oh, well, it'll be new-ish.
But I feel the impressive thing about henges is how hard it is for ancient people to move the giant rocks, or how impressive it is that aliens did it or whatever. Because if you could just use a crane, it's just a circle of rocks.
Are you certain that it wasn't constructed in 2015 by aliens?
Because it could have been constructed by aliens in 2015, in which case it would be awesome again.
I'm just saying it might be a nice little scenic thing that could be mentioned.
Some rocks in a circle. Yes.
Yes. We also have the War Years. It's a war museum. I could see Strike liking that.
Yeah, like if they have a free afternoon while they're waiting for whatever they came here to do.
Or maybe they have to interview someone there.
Yeah, okay.
Same thing with Summer House Gallery, an art gallery.
I was noticing that this art gallery, it sells art too. And I don't know if you guys saw the pictures, but whenever she was leaving, she had like a thing that looked like a print.
Joe, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, it'd be cute if Strike saw a painting of the sea that he loved and bought it for his flat, the opposite of Murphy buying an antique map.
No, but you know what?
You know,
Robin thinks to herself that she specifically doesn't point things out for Murphy because she doesn't want to give him the impression.
But if she says, Strike, get it for your fucking flat, you've got no art. Okay, and he does. That hits my Robin telling Strike what to do button as well.
There's also St. Peter's Church. I feel like churches are mentioned. fairly often.
It's a very cozy feeling church, like on the inside.
I didn't look at it.
Yeah, it's kind of small, kind of cozy.
Then we have the Heritage Room, which is another museum. It's also a library and a meeting room.
Masons?
I think that there is a Masonic temple somewhere, I think, in Guernsey.
There's also the Sark Observatory. That would be cool.
They could watch the stars together.
Romantic.
And there's like got to be like no light pollution out there. So I bet it's beautiful.
There's a chocolate gift shop. Robin would like that.
And so would Shrike. We're a bunch of chocolate lovers.
There's a place called Mermaid Tavern. It says it's a bar with snacks. They can go have a drink there.
Like in that one Merlin's grotto that Shrike picked out.
Yeah.
I was about to say, it sounds like something that would pop up in the book. Mermaid Tavern.
It does. Yeah. And then the last thing is it mentions the horse and carriages and boat trips. I would love to see the carriages.
Mm-hmm. I think that the lack of transportation, paved surfaces is definitely going to be a big part of these chapters for Shrike with his mobility. And I too would love to see them take a horse-drawn carriage because whatever banter they have about it would be guaranteed to be hilarious.
I hope it's a tight squeeze.
A tight squeeze. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Their thighs touching, electric shocks, the
whole. Oh my God. Yep.
Mm-hmm. All right. So if you want to get into some history or lore, I did find a website that talks about some things of Sark. We have monks, pirates, and folklore.
Fun.
Yes. Okay. So there's a legend that Sark's patron saint led the monks in defending Sark from Viking attacks. But that eventually the monastery was destroyed during a raid led by the infamous Viking chieftain. It says for some 200 years afterwards, the island remained uninhabited, a haven for pirates and wreckers who with false lights would lure ships onto the surrounding rocks and plunder them.
You know, Cornwall also has a history of pirates and wreckers. I'm not sure it's going to be relevant to the book unless hidden pirate treasure plays a part in the plot.
Hidden pirate treasure would be really cool.
It would be cool. Maybe not super likely, but fun.
Well, I want to see a swashbuckling Strike.
He's already
he
got
already
the
has
leg.
The peg leg.
With the unbuttoned shirt, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I don't think he'd be up for the parrot because he had a bad, you know, encounter with the...
with a bird.
With the bird. Yeah. So, man, yeah, not no so bird. Much for the parrot.
I really like this other legend called the Legend of the Coffin. So this is Sark's own version of the Trojan horse. It tells of how a group of merchants tired of being attacked by the troublesome pirates in Sark planned a clever ambush. As the story goes, the merchant sailed to Sark and called out to the pirate sentries that their captain had died at sea. They requested to bury him in the sacred grounds of the chapel and offered a reward. The pirates agreed on the condition that the men landed unarmed. The merchants rowed ashore with only the coffin and hauled it up the hill to the chapel, where they were allowed to hold a brief service in private. Once inside the chapel, the merchants broke open the coffin, which was full of swords and longbows, and they burst out of the building, slaughtering everyone in sight. The only survivor was an old woman who was baking bread at the time of the attack. Quickly grabbing a loaf, she ran to the coupe, climbed down the Jersey side, and she basically hid in a cave where she lived off of the bread until she was rescued.
Nice.
That's a fun little story. I think the moral of the story is make more bread.
Get your sourdough starter going again.
Just a couple other little fun things. Up until the 1900s, most islanders also believed in...
Pukulays, if I had to guess.
Pukulays sounds right. Yeah.
Pukulays. Okay. The sometimes helpful and often petulant Channel Island pixies who lived in the caves. Setting them apart from the others, the Sark Pukulays had detachable heads and enjoyed smoking pipes when not causing mischief. It kind of sounds like Peeves.
Does sound like Peeves, actually. Yeah.
I was just thinking that it sounded like the start of a lesson with Gilderoy Lockhart.
Yeah. And then the last thing it says, still today, the island attracts many alternative thinkers and practitioners from all walks of life. Traditional customs are still practiced within the community, including a tradition dating back to the Middle Ages where islanders gather in one building to pass the long winter night by knitting, crafting, singing, and storytelling beside the fire.
That sounds nice. Sounds lovely. What are the chances of one of those happening in February? So that, because that'd be cute. Alternative thinkers is an interesting phrase. Like, is it the kind of alternative thinkers who are going to annoy the shit out of Strike?
Maybe. Possibly.
Very possibly. Like, what kind of person are they going to Sark to deal with is my question.
They have to be meeting someone or wanting to find someone, interview.
Yeah. Who is on Sark?
Previous legends in history don't often play a role.
No. Still interesting,
in
though.
The case.
Sometimes they get a passing mention.
Yeah.
It's good to know. Gives us a beautiful picture of the setting.
So we've had three headers, right? So we have the Freemason building.
Yeah.
Sark. La Coupe. And then this silver ship. And we have a title.
I was just thinking about how, like, a few episodes ago, I was like, well, you know, we'll have to wait to see what the Freemason stuff is until we get more headers. And then here we are. We have three headers about this book. Mm-hmm. Three. Crazy. That's incredible.
It's amazing.
Are we ready to get into the chapter?
All right. Yes. Let's get into chapter 71.
Okay. In chapter 71, Robin speaks with Will while making dinner and notices him beginning to doubt the UHC. And then the epigraph for this chapter says, even in the midst of danger, there come intervals of peace. If we possess enough inner strength, we shall take advantage of these intervals. And that is from Hexagram 5, Waiting Nourishment.
I think this might be talking about these moments of clarity Will is starting to show, where his true self comes through. We see in this chapter that he's having moments of doubt, and Robin will use this to her advantage.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, it might just be that I enjoy cooking, but the image of standing chopping a pile of onions with someone, it just feels like a literal moment of peace as well. Also, it's very clever that this chapter takes place in a kitchen when the hexagram is nourishment.
The start of this chapter is quite stressful because you can just feel the tension building. Mm-hmm. She's made an ally in Jang, but Becca's made it clear that she's now after her. Robin knows her slip-ups could pop up at any moment, and with every day that passes, Tayo is getting more aggravated that she hasn't come to him to ask for spirit bonding.
God, it's too much anxiety for me.
Mm-hmm.
Can't, like, escape, Robin.
I know. How many days does she have left? We're getting close to the Drowned Prophet manifestation, because all the principals are back. So Noli Seymour's back, Dr. Zhao, Giles Harmon.
So it is July 14th in this chapter, and she comes out on July 30th.
Okay.
So not too much longer.
Ugh.
I just think it's so funny that she comes out so close to Joe's birthday. It's like, happy birthday to you.
Or to Neville.
Mm. That too. Yeah.
His actual birthday.
I feel like Joe was like, waking up in one bed together, but they're present to me.
Oh, and she knows more about what was going on in their heads or strikes. I feel like Robin was too, she's just knocked out, right?
But she knows, yeah.
Strike's thoughts. I wonder if we're going to get more of his thoughts about that night.
About how they held hands for 5 minutes. Yeah.
Thinking how he felt sleeping next to her, waking up next to her.
I wonder that as well.
Oh my God, we're going to get to see that. I'm just imagining like the camera panning down the bed to focus down on their hands. Oh my God.
Oh, I want him like looking away when she comes out in his t-shirt.
My God. Duh. Okay. I can't handle any of this.
Sorry.
I can't handle any of that.
Robin is sent to help in the kitchen, and she immediately goes to help Will cut some onions.
I did not know this cooking tip about onions not stinging your eyes if you freeze them first. I'm going to have to try that.
Mm-hmm. Real pro tip.
I don't know if it works.
I believe Robin.
I can choose to believe it.
Robin knows what she's talking about.
It feels really significant here that Will smiles at Robin. I think it's probably the first kind gesture he's made towards her.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly because she's helping him with the onions when he's struggling, but maybe also because he is experiencing this doubt. He's seeing things more clearly, that strict way of thinking. He's lightening up a bit.
I think it's like the real Will coming through again. Going back to that quote from the Stephen Hassan book about the cult self being a separate persona.
Yeah.
This was the real self, the real Will coming through right here. But his response to Robin trying to flatter or provoke him is so revealing because he says it dully. His heart is not in this cult thing anymore. I think we can all sense, Robin included, that he is not going to need much pushing to reach the breaking point with the UHC.
Robin starts talking to Will about how long he's been with the UHC, and there's this part here where Robin says that she got a glimpse of the Drowned Prophet at her revelation, and Will says that he had heard about that.
This isn't surprising or anything that this got around, but it does illustrate how gossip really spreads in the UHC. I bet everyone's heard about Robin's revelation.
Oh, everyone. Yep.
Again, so unfair.
Very unfair.
Very unfair.
Not fair at all.
Okay, let's talk about Will mentioning the library.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, this makes me smile as a Harry Potter fan. It's very much that thing of need an answer to something? Off to the library.
Exactly. Right? When in doubt, go to the library.
Yeah.
Quite. But where does anyone here in this cult find time to go to the library? Are the other recruits less scheduled than Robin is? Because I feel like our girl has had not a single second of downtime this whole book.
I wonder if saying you want to go read in the library is allowed in the same way that spirit bonding is. They just get to leave and go.
I mean, how are they not doing that all the time? Oh my God. If that is the case, then Robin, say you need to go to the library, find the biggest book in there to hide behind, and then have a nap.
But this library does not sound as fun as the Hogwarts library.
No.
It says, though beautifully appointed with mahogany tables and brass reading lights, the library contained few books, and half of them had been written by Jonathan Wace. The rest of the stock comprised holy texts of all major religions.
You know, I think that I will take cursed and screaming books from the restricted section over books from Jonathan Wace any day.
Yeah.
Yeah, this library is an insult to libraries. You know, I am offended on the behalf of books.
Will asks Robin if she's read the Bible, and here's what Will says. I was reading it yesterday, John chapter 1, verse 4, 1. Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are from God, for many false prophets have gone out into the world. Like I said before, I do find this part of the book to be one of those moments where I think there's Christian symbolism at play. Obviously, we talked about this last time with the church, the cross, and baptism, but here I think the significance is the contrast we see with the phony spiritualism of the UHC versus Will seeking and finding truth and guidance in the Bible. From my perspective, that is a clear point being made. However, the thing that really interests me about this part and the thing that instantly popped in my head was Helter Skelter. And I know that probably sounds weird, but hear me out.
Tell us about it.
This verse that Will is talking about and there being false prophets is very similar to a Bible verse that is used as an epigraph in the book Helter Skelter. For anyone who isn't familiar, Helter Skelter is a book about the Manson family, the murders, and most of all, the trial. It was written by Vincent Bugliosi, who was the prosecutor in that case. So it's a really great book if you're interested in how the case was put together and how it was prosecuted. But in part 5 of Helter Skelter, there are 3 epigraphs. And the first is a Bible verse, Matthew 24, verses 24 and 26. For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall shew great signs and wonders, insomuch that, if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect. Wherefore, if they shall say unto you, behold, he is in the desert, go not forth. So the significance of the desert is much more relevant to the Manson family than it is to the UHC, because that'll happen here in Southern California. Manson was literally trying to move them all to the desert. But the rest of that, I think it fits perfectly with the UHC and the false prophets deceiving the very elect. I just think it's really interesting, given the fact that the Manson family is referenced in this book before. I'm not saying that this is what she was thinking of when she decided to have Will read this verse, but it's another connection to a very real and infamous cult that's tied to this fictional one that I really enjoyed. And it is very, very good information for Robin to have that Will is thinking this way.
Yeah, I agree. Very good information. This is a glaring neon sign that Will is on the brink of getting out of this cult, because he's already out of here intellectually. It's only his heart keeping him connected because of Ching and Lin.
My excitement about the Helter Skelter connection was a bit ruined, though, because my favorite person, Nolly Seymour, shows up. She comes over to help Will and Robin with the onions.
Yeah.
Nolly, unlike Shrek, is not like an onion. She does not have layers.
I love that. Now I'm just over here wondering what character from Shrek she is.
The fairy godmother? Maybe that's too important. Maybe just one of Farquaad's guards.
There you go.
Pick number 3, my lord. That's her.
Yeah, definitely.
That's her because he holds up 2 fingers and says, pick number 3, my lord. Like, he's not very bright, you know? Yeah, that one's Nolly.
Nice.
I love this line. If Nolly had imagined a stampede to assist her, or that the kitchen workers would be charmed by her admission of helplessness, she'd miscalculated. Yeah. It's just so funny that they all seem as annoyed with her as I feel.
It is funny. You know what? It felt so accurate to me. So having worked in kitchens, there are places that you can pull this bullshit and kind of get away with it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Kitchens aren't one of them. Something about the presence of the fire and the knives, it just leaves like a lower tolerance for this specific brand of nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
Nolly trying to cut onions is giving me the strong vibes of that one Kardashian sister trying to cut a cucumber.
Yes.
Yeah.
The one with Kendall Jenner. Oh my God. Yes. It's downright painful. Like, tell me you've never had to prepare your own food in your life without telling me you've
so
never done it.
So funny.
When Noli asks them their names, she tells them how she played Rowena in Ivanhoe. I really wanted to find some fun connection between The Running Grave and Ivanhoe, like we did with Tannhäuser and Inkblack Heart. I don't know. I'm not that familiar with Ivanhoe, so maybe someone else can find something really good.
Yeah, I think I tried to read Ivanhoe when I was a kid, but I didn't get very far, so...
I have a brief memory of this from school, but not too much.
I know very little.
The thing that I found most interesting, just from some of the analysis I read, was mostly about the religious figures in the book. So this is just from Spark Notes, but someone wrote, each of the three religious characters is in some way a sham. The Templar, supposedly a holy knight, is an outright villain. The Prior is addicted to food, wine, and pleasure. And the Palmer, supposedly a gentle pilgrim, is not a Palmer at all. He is Ivanhoe in disguise. So I think these kind of match up really nicely. The Templar being an outright villain could be Jonathan Wace. The Prior, addicted to food, wine, pleasure, could be Tayo. The Palmer, not really religious at all, but the hero in disguise, that's Robin.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that makes sense. That's brilliant.
Yeah, I really liked that.
Something else I saw. So Ivanhoe comes back to England after fighting alongside Richard the Lionheart in the Crusades. Is that not also basically Robin Hood's backstory?
Yeah, Robin Hood is actually in Ivanhoe, although he's not named. He's called Locksley. From what I've read, Robin Hood was really popular at the time, so the little references to him were exciting for readers.
Okay.
So there are a lot of Robin Hood bits. There's Prince John and Ivanhoe and stuff like that. Yes. There are a lot of Robin Hood bits in The Running Grave, aren't there?
There are. There are a bunch.
Mm-hmm.
And this is very interesting. So there is, in a way, a very strong Rowena to Robin connection here, right? So we can move from Lady Rowena to Robin via the Robin Hood Ivanhoe connection.
I don't know. I'm just thinking maybe it's less about Ivanhoe and more about Robin Hood, because we do have some connections here in this book. We have Little John.
Yes.
Robin Hood is mentioned when Robin answers her own name.
Yeah.
There were other things too.
Marion, I think. Maybe Marion.
Marion.
There were a few. John and Jonathan Wace. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's interesting.
It is.
Maybe there's something there. I don't know. Noli comments on Lady Rowena from Ivanhoe, saying that she's basically just, you know, beautiful and kind and noble. Noli rolled her eyes. And I'm like, wouldn't it be easier to use a mannequin or something? Sorry, I'm giving Noli a total Valley Girl accent. I didn't mean to do that.
I mean, I feel like that's accurate. But
like I said, I don't know a ton, so I don't know if Lady Rowena has a lot going on, but it's definitely funny that Noli sees herself as so much more than this when, let's face it, there's not much going on with her, right?
Yeah.
No. There is something about her reducing Lady Rowena's kindness to a mannequin that I don't really like.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. Like, Noli is telling on herself here about what she considers interesting personality traits.
Right. Mm-hmm. Kindness is not one of those things.
Mm-hmm.
Also, had to roll my eyes big time at Noli saying that she just gets typecast as the beautiful character and she wants to play someone with character.
Oh my God.
Try having some yourself, lady.
Right. Mm. Amen to that.
Preach. Don't you just hate when you get typecast as the beautiful character?
Oh, it's such a struggle. I'm playing the world's tiniest violin. Will then asked Noli about her plans to make a film about the UHC or the Drowned Prophet.
That would be such a terrible movie. Like, it would be so bad. But say, having said that, I'd totally pirate it and have a bad movie watch party. Come up with a fun drinking game.
Take a shot
who's going to win a Razzie. Yeah, take a shot when it's very obviously a fake ghost, etc.
Mm-hmm. I feel like they'd give Dayu the Touched by an Angel treatment where they kind of glow. Do you know what I mean?
That would be so funny. I know exactly. You mean my mom loved that show.
My mom too.
Oh my god, that's a mom show.
It's a mom show.
Very much a mom show.
I'm really interested in Noli's desire to play Jennifer Wace, Jonathan Wace's first wife. She says, I'd quite like to play his first wife because he's told me a bit about her and she sounds like a, well, she was no Lady Rowena, put it that way.
The fuck does that mean, Noli?
She was a what? I think I know the word she was gonna say. This is only now registering as important to me because it's a direct contrast to what Abigail believes about her parents' relationship. She believes that he really loved her mother, but it definitely seems like Jonathan Wace is bad-mouthing his dead first wife to Nolie Seymour years and years after her death.
Wow.
It does.
What a shit.
So I want to know what he said. Somehow I don't believe him.
For some reason.
For some reason. I'll have to think about what that reason is. I can't put my finger on it, but it's right there.
Speaking of the movie, though, I wonder if she'd be more or less interested in doing a movie about this when she knows exactly what happened to Dayu.
Oh, now that movie I'd watch.
Right?
Not if Nolie was in it, but no. I would definitely watch an adaptation of like the true story. Or a cult documentary on Netflix about this.
I think Nolie Seymour is going to try and distance herself as much as possible.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 100%. She's not doing any movie about this.
Okay. I love this next moment when Will, in front of everyone, calls Jonathan Wace and Mazu out for being married when no one else in the church is supposed to marry.
Oh, drop the mic.
But this is a huge deal that Will said this in front of everyone.
Right? Like, what?
And even one person was like, Will.
That's a box.
Like a warning.
That exactly. He risked a lot to say that in front of everybody.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That is good information for Robin again.
Will asks Nolie if she's ever read Bhagavad Gita, which is Hindu scripture.
It really makes me laugh when it says, yes, of course, said Nolie, clearly lying.
It's so funny because I remember someone saying... We study any and every holy book in an earlier interview. I guess that we didn't actually mean we in the sense that it included the I.
There's no we in Nolie, but there is an I.
Yes. And that I did not read the Bhagavad Gita.
No, she didn't. No. But Will comes out strong with this and quotes it saying, Lord Krishna talks about people of demonic nature, self-conceited, stubborn, intoxicated by pride and wealth. They perform sacrifice in name only with ostentation.
Oh, oh, I'm like that GIF Kens of the, oh, shit. You know?
Yeah.
Will is straight up insulting Nolie Seymour to her face, but she is too stupid to understand that that's what's happening. Calling her conceited, intoxicated by pride and wealth, performing sacrifice, but not really sacrificing anything. This is absolutely Nolie Seymour, and I love Will in this moment. It is so funny.
Yes,
it is definitely an endearing moment for him.
It is, yeah. Mm-hmm. And her response, oh my God, there are so many people enacting like that. Not realizing that she's being insulted, it's hilarious to me.
Oh my God. It. The complete lack of self-awareness on her part is just incredible.
I mean, to be fair, I don't know that she knows what half of those words even mean.
That's
she
a good
doesn't
point.
Seem like particularly intellectual.
These don't sound good. I don't know what they mean, but they don't sound good.
You could possibly stretch this another way to where he's talking also about Jonathan Wace, because I think that this all applies to him as well. But yeah. I do think that he is insulting her to her face.
Big time.
I think it's safe to assume that Will read this in the same library where he was reading the Bible. I just think it's very fitting that the UHC uses the idea that there's truth in all religions to hook people in. But here it's kind of backfiring when the Bible gives him doubts about the UHC and the Gita gives him an incredible way to insult a principal.
They didn't expect anyone to actually do the reading.
All right, so Nolie gets cut off here towards the end, but her voice was drowned out by another. Somebody outside the kitchen was screaming. Dun, dun, dun.
Oh, scary.
Oh, man. Let's get right into it. Chapter 72.
Yep. Chapter 72. Robin witnesses the result of Lynn's attempt to terminate her pregnancy.
And the epigraph, 9 in the third place. The woman carries a child but does not bring it forth. Misfortune. That's hexagram 53, development, gradual progress. This is clearly talking about Lynn using the plants to end her pregnancy. Yeah. I wasn't sure if she succeeded at first because it doesn't really tell us, but I think the epigraph is actually telling us that she did.
I agree. Yes. And it absolutely succeeded.
We don't ever hear about her being pregnant later in the book. So
no. And to me, the amount of blood that Robin is describing in this upcoming chapter is
it's a lot of blood.
Oh God. I just realized we had a miscarriage and troubled blood and a miscarriage and running grave. Yep.
Picking up where the last chapter left off, we see Penny coming into the kitchens. She has blood all over her and says that it's Lynn.
I can't help but notice that Will takes off running at once.
He is a good egg.
Pat is right. You know what? This is the case where Pat actually has a correct character judgment.
Oh,
amazing.
Amazing.
She too is making changes.
There you go. There's this brief moment where Will stops writing because men aren't allowed in the women's dormitory.
Mm.
I can't help but think of Ron trying to run up the stairs to the girls' dormitory and then it turning into a slide. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yep, same.
I am glad for this rule, though. I wouldn't worry too much about someone like Will going in there, but some of the others, would I want Jang in there.
Absolutely.
Imagine him. Not. Jang is so Norman Bates. You know, he'd be in there with the peepholes in the bathroom showers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I kind of do picture him a little bit like Norman Bates, actually.
Yeah.
He's got that look in my mind. Yeah.
But going back to what's happening here. So Robin arrives in the bathroom and the image of this puddle of blood spreading underneath the stall doors and Lynn's unmoving legs.
Yeah.
I think at this point we've officially entered the horror zone of the cult chapters. And we are not getting out of the horror zone until Robin does. We're in it now.
I'm hearing the Twilight Zone music.
Yeah.
You have now entered the horror zone.
The horror zone. We're here. It's so fun. Mm-hmm.
I was impressed with Robin's ability to jump over the cubicle wall, though, and get to Lynn.
Yeah. A surprising display of upper body strength, you might say.
It was, yeah.
And considering how starved she's been of calories and protein, it's even more impressive.
I'm trying to imagine myself doing it. I probably would have jammed my stomach with the top. Wouldn't have made it far enough. Yeah, exactly.
Just winded yourself.
I'd have had better luck just throwing myself at the stall door to break it open. I'm not going to lie.
I feel like sliding underneath would have worked as well.
In the blood puddle, I'm going to know for me, dog.
If you had to.
I guess, yes. But yes. I'm just going to throw myself at the stall door and that lock's going to snap. I'll put money on it.
Okay.
Next public bathroom I'm in, I'm not going to try and snap a lock because I'm not a vandal. I wouldn't do that.
I'm just imagining you, boom, Pools was here. Boom.
But I could do it, is the point. Okay. Yes.
They say that they're going to get Dr. Zhu and they're telling Lynn that it's going to be okay.
Lynn says it won't be okay if they get him. Do you think she means because he might stop it? Is that what she's worried about?
I think so, yeah.
This poor baby girl, she's 16 years old. But also, maybe she's saying that because she knows that this man has zero medical qualifications and also that he's a monster.
Or maybe she's just afraid he'll bring some green tea with him.
Oh, God.
Not the green tea.
No. I would be afraid.
Or she doesn't want his hands anywhere near her, which that's fair too.
This part breaks my heart a little when he shows up and it says, Robin remained exactly where she was and felt Lynn's fingers tighten on hers as Zhu appeared in the open doorway.
You know what? If there's one thing we know about Robin, she will always fight to protect those who can't protect themselves. Always, even at the cost of her own safety. Lynn needs her, so she is not letting go of Lynn. Just in case no one is aware, I really, really love Robin Ellicott.
We'll talk about this a little bit more when we get to the Artemis bit, but yes, she is a protector. Mm-hmm. Lynn says that the plant she ate was mugwort. I did look this up and Wikipedia says toxicity to humans is believed to be weak, though some studies have linked high concentration to seizures and an abortive effect. The Botanical Safety Handbook suggests that the mugwort not be used during pregnancy unless it's under supervision of a medical expert.
And you know what? Not to get all political on the podcast,
but you're gonna.
This situation is what you get when you take away women's reproductive choices. Desperate women will do dangerous things because they don't have a choice.
Yeah, not that Lynn has access to that, but yes, I think that could be definitely a point J.K. Rowling's trying to make. Yeah. I think she's made her opinions on the matter quite clear.
Well, yeah. Next, we have Robin arguing with Zhao. Pushing Tayo's hand away. Oh my God. I gasped when she said, are you mad to Zhao? Because that's going to get her punished 100%. I was terrified for her.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she is too, because it says the ramifications of what had just happened were hitting Robin. She wondered whether Lynn was going to die, whether Zhao was competent to deal with the emergencies. She also knew she'd reacted to the crisis as Robin Ellicott, not as Rowena Ellis, shouting at Zhao and ignoring his orders, pushing Tayo away, siding with the girl who tried to abort her baby. Then there was her admission she knew Lynn had eaten plants.
Yep.
And I'm like, run, Robin.
Yes,
please.
The stress. Why am I feeling stressed now?
Right?
When I was reading the book for the second time, I was listening to it and I was telling my husband how stressed I was.
Yep.
And he's like, how can you be stressed? You already know what happens. Bro? Bro, don't come at me with that. What do you mean? Stressful. How can I be
don't
stressed?
Don't come at me with logic and facts.
It's very stressful. It's unpleasant. It's scary.
And when you have anxiety, you know, the brain has its reasons, which reasons don't know. Isn't that how it goes, Pulse?
You would have to ask Catherine Kent, I guess.
Well, she just did.
Oh my God. I'm on strike. I wish.
But yeah, it's just, I feel like this book is going to be stressful no matter how many times you read it. Mm-hmm. And there's the whole paragraph where she thinks that her time is up. She has to leave. If only Penny would go away, she could jump out the bathroom window and make a run for it. Oh. I can't believe how close we were to her running.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Penny does leave and she takes two steps forward to the sink and the window when Louise shows up.
God damn it, Louise.
Ugh. She says that Papa Jay wants to see her.
God damn it, Papa Jay.
Ugh. So stressful.
Yeah. Ripping my hair out at this point.
Oh, yeah.
Is it easier reading this because I know she escapes eventually? Or is it worse reading this because I know what she's about to go through and I hate it?
I think it is easier reading it knowing what happens. Mm. But, oh boy. Just picture hand-holding in bed.
Right.
Everyone picture it in your mind. Yes. Take a deep breath.
Oh, 5 whole minutes.
In through the nose, out through the mouth.
We got it. We got this.
Okay, let's go to the next chapter quickly so that we can do a cult chapter cleanse at the end of it.
Cult chapter cleanse.
Do we need a theme song?
It's cult chapter cleanse. I'd love it.
Okay, that works. Cult chapter cleanse.
Cult chapter cleanse. Spirit fingers. Yeah.
All right, chapter 73.
All right. In chapter 73, Robin has a rather unpleasant encounter with Jonathan Wace.
It is rather unpleasant.
So the epigraph to this chapter reads, "We find ourselves close to the Commander of Darkness." That's a hexagram 36, darkening of the light.
This is pretty straightforward. Jonathan Wace is the Commander of Darkness, and we do find ourselves quite close to him.
Unfortunately. Yes. The hexagram states, "Here a man of dark nature is in a position of authority and brings harm to the wise and able man." Read. Woman. Mm-hmm. And that is exactly what's happening here.
You can really feel the fear in Robin at the beginning of this chapter when her legs won't work properly. Mm-hmm. And it says that her tongue was sticking to the roof of her mouth, all while she's trying to figure out if she'd be able to escape, realizing that she can't.
God, this is so hard to read.
I know.
I wish I wasn't out of wine.
The part that says, "Having daubed her forehead with water, she followed Louise toward the dragon carved doors of the farmhouse." It really feels like she's literally entering a dragon's den, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's not the fun kind where she's going to go on TV and get a bunch of money and publicity to launch her awesome product.
Is it called Dragon's Den for you?
Yeah, it's called Dragon's Den.
Oh, ours is Shark Tank.
Oh, lame. Dragon's Den is way better.
Oh, I know sharks are way better, obviously.
Agree to disagree.
Okay.
But in any case, this is not the fun kind. This is the kind where she can walk in and then get eaten.
We have a lot of color mentioned here when the farmhouse is being described, which isn't too strange if you're describing a place, but we have scarlet carpeted staircase, the black door to Jonathan Wace's office, and then inside, he has peacock blue walls.
Oh.
So first, the red and black could be a bit of a literary alchemy here, paired with maybe Robin's white tracksuit, which is also partially red with blood.
Yeah, it reads very good versus evil to me, where both are bloodstained, because that's what the cult does, right? It's an evil that takes good people and makes them complicit in committing horrible, awful acts. It literally puts blood on its members' hands or tracksuits.
With Robin being in white, being the good, the and good he has the black stained door.
He's black and then the red, yeah.
And then, okay, peacock blue again, his walls associated now with Charlotte Bijou and Jonathan Wace.
Deliberate pattern, yes.
Peacock blue is evil, apparently.
It's like a superficial beauty covering up something quite nasty.
If peacock blue is like an obstacle that you have to overcome, right? Strike with Charlotte and Bijou.
The echoes Jonathan again. Wace. Strike in the Bijou.
Robin with Jonathan Wace.
Here, yeah.
There we go.
There we go.
So I had very mixed feelings here at the beginning of this interaction because I was relieved that it seemed like she wasn't about to be punished for what just happened.
Yeah.
Wace said she was forgiven for how she spoke to Zhu, but I knew something was coming.
Yeah. When Wace hugs her, this is terrifying to me. Because you can feel the power he has over her. not physical and institutional power. I guess what I mean is the way he's crushing her, refusing to let her go. It's, yes, the usual physical menace of he's bigger, he's stronger, he could hurt her. But more than that, with Robin's reaction, you can sense there's nothing Robin can do to even try to fight back, right? Because of his intangible status and power, what he could have done to her. She can't fight back against him.
This is a really scary chapter.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah.
When Robin asks if Lynn is going to be okay, it says that Jonathan Wace quoted, "The way of the Yang goes to and fro, up and down." This is actually from the I Ching, Hexagram 24, Return, the Turning Point. I was wondering if there was anything you can make from this, Pools.
Well, one interesting thing was that this specific hexagram refers to the winter solstice, so the point at which the night is longest and where we begin to move towards spring and renewal. It feels to me like a bit of a reverse echo with what Strike just experienced, which was Charlotte's death at the summer solstice, the point where the nights start growing longer. But for Strike, that moment was a moment of renewal and rebirth. But for Robin, she is now just entering the darkest and most terrifying time of her experience in this cult.
So you're saying that dark and difficult times lie ahead?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This just in, so. Bulls was Dumbledore in another life.
It's my beard. I find, so when Robin tells Wace, "I saw her with the plants at some time," mm-hmm. and he asks Robin, "When was this?" I find this to be triple infuriating, because how the hell is she supposed to know, man? Mm-hmm. You won't let anyone have a calendar. She has to secretly collect rocks to track the days. How is she even supposed to answer that question? Like, it was a day in the past sometime? Come on, man.
It's a trick question.
Oh, it's an infuriating question to me.
More stress for me when Jonathan Wace changes the subject from Lynn to Robin and says that he's heard conflicting reports. We talked about this before, that these conflicting reports are when the Rowena mask slips and we're seeing the real Robin.
And he lays the whole thing out right here for us.
I know.
Like, he lays, I'm so scared.
Mm-hmm.
I know it ends, but I'm still so scared. Like, what if this time it's different and he figures it out, you know?
Mm-hmm. I know.
Right? You never
what
know.
What if? You don't know. Oh, but then we get to Wace saying he's going to call her Artemis.
I actually love this.
It's a good name.
It is, but he doesn't even know how good it is.
He doesn't know.
Yeah. When he says this, he mentions her helping Juan deliver the baby, her helping Emily in Norwich, and defending her from Jang, and her being the first to rush to help Lynn. He says, "There are many contradictions in Artemis, as in so many human representations of the divine. She's a huntress, but also protector of the hunted, of girls up to marriageable age, the goddess of childbirth, and strangely, of chastity." Obviously, the bit about chastity is a reference to her refusal to sleep with Tayo, but I don't want to miss the significance of what comes before that. Mm-hmm. He is saying that Artemis is the protector of the hunted and of girls.
Yes.
They have all noticed that Robin is a protector of the women and girls at Chapman Farm, and that is a threat to them.
Mm-hmm. Goddamn right she is. Mm-hmm. That's our Robin. Also, fun fact, Artemis turned a peeping Tom into a deer once, and then he was devoured by his own hunting dogs. And you know what? I support that.
Justice.
Justice indeed.
This really, it gets me in my feelings, because if there is anything that Robin is, she's a protector. Yeah. And she is going to protect these vulnerable women and girls because she can't help it.
Oh.
Before we all read the book, we talked about the possibility that Robin would not be able to not act if she saw someone in trouble, right? And for a while, I thought that this didn't happen because she was really cautious, but she actually did this very thing the entire time, and they all spotted it. Mm. Robin is Artemis because she is a protector of the hunted.
1,000 times, yes.
But Artemis is also a hunter herself, and that is also true for Robin. She's absolutely hunting those who deserve it, right? She's hunting them while also protecting the vulnerable hunted.
God, the whole reason that Robin is here at all is to hunt these assholes, to skewer them with her arrows. And Artemis is known for fucking up the people who cross her, which Wace and his cronies are about to discover, to my endless delight.
I feel like Wace really underestimated her being the hunter in this situation. Because when Robin mentions earlier, she's the hunter, right? Mm-hmm. He dismisses that and says, well, there's more important things to her.
Yeah.
He's dismissing this and not realizing the danger she actually is. He's about to find out.
Well, I mean, that's what happens when you fuck around.
You do find out, so I've heard.
You find out. I mean, it's a pretty accurate nickname.
It really is.
I mean, it's gross because it's coming from Waste, but she does embody a lot of the most badass parts of Artemis.
She does. The thing I like the most about it is that he doesn't understand the hunter part.
Yep.
So I'm puzzled by you, Artemis. On the one hand, passivity, unquestioning obedience, an uncomplaining work ethic, a journal that asks no questions, a large donation to the church. But on the other hand, a strong and dynamic individuality. Outside of doctrinal seminars, you challenge authority and resist deeper engagement with the church's precepts. You demonstrate a strong materialist adherence to the importance of the body over the requirements of the spirit. Why these contradictions, Artemis?
This is, again, Rowena versus Robin, and it's kind of scary to think about how much they've noticed it.
As a reminder of how closely everyone is being watched in this place, they have seen all of this.
Yeah.
You know, this also sort of feels like a connection of the case to the personal a bit as well, kind of showing the difference between the strong and dynamic person we now know her to be versus the passivity we sort of see her demonstrate in the other parts of her life.
Oh, good point, Kens.
It's a bit of a stark contrast, right?
Yeah.
It's like, hey, it doesn't make sense.
That definitely exists within Robin, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
She's so much more willing to be brave to help other people, but we're less likely to see her be brave when it comes to her own heart.
Her own happiness. She puts it to the side.
It's okay. She's going to get there.
Hopefully.
Oh, you know what line I love from Silkworm is when she thinks that she just wants to mesh the two parts of her life together.
Oh, bless her heart.
I think it's also significant that Wei said that people noticed the only time she did challenge the church doctrine was to Will. Mm. Not that I think they've made the connection that she's there for him because she's behaving differently with him. But honestly, if it went on much longer, I feel like they might have figured it out, especially since Will's family has already sent in investigators.
Yeah, I agree. Wace is clearly suspicious here.
Yeah.
They're on to her a bit. They don't know for sure. They haven't properly identified her, but Wace's sustar is pinging.
With a capital S.
Yes.
We've talked about this before, but it's also a bit unnerving how many eyes are on her. Wace hasn't seen any of this for himself. This is just what everyone has told him.
I wonder if the people at the farm were noticing and sending up red flags about her, or if Wace was interested in her and asked for them to pay more attention, specifically leading to them seeing the red flags. Like, what was the order of events there?
This is a chicken and egg situation, Pools.
Yeah, it is.
I don't know.
For some reason, I just had the mental image of instead of the hills have eyes, it's the carrots have eyes.
Oh.
So Wace talks to Robin about Will failing to reach pure spirit because he can't get beyond step 6 when it says that the pure spirit knows acceptance is more important than understanding.
I really identify with Will here a lot. I have not once in my life ever been able to just accept something because someone says so. I always need to understand. Always.
Oh, yeah.
Very absolutely. Willish in that respect. Difficult, some parents of mine might say.
Some parents.
I think we go back a bit to Robin being a protector of the hunted here because Wace points out that her instinct to protect Emily against Jang also seems to apply to other disruptives such as Emily and Will. Again, I really love this. I know it's a little scary, but it's such a huge part of who Robin is. It's something that she and Strike have in common too, because we've talked before about how he also protects vulnerable people.
Oh, well, now I'm just swan diving into the emotions closet, right?
Right.
Strike and Robin, defenders of the vulnerable.
If you're going to dive, do a swan one.
Well,
no. You know, it's appropriate.
How else could I dive?
My heart stopped when Wace mentioned her revelation and said that Dayu appears when she senses a threat to the church. Yeah. It's very clear that she's in trouble here. Mm-hmm. A threat. And you know what? She is a threat.
She is.
God damn right, she is.
It says, you can't think I'm a threat to the church. The words came out as a whisper, which wasn't feigned. Robin's throat felt constricted. Well, let's see, said Wace without smiling. Stand up for me.
We don't really need to describe the sexual assault that comes next when he puts his hands on her.
Yeah.
Thankfully, that's all he has the chance to do. I do wonder how far he would have pushed this if he hadn't been interrupted.
I don't doubt that he would have raped her. I do think that Robin would have fought him.
Mm-hmm.
She froze in this 1 second, but she'd have fought. Thank God he was interrupted.
Yes.
Okay, the chapter ends with Mazu and Becca entering the office, both furious and jealous, to find his hands on her. And then, thank God, Robin is free to go.
I felt like I was able to release a deep breath that I had been holding, you know. And you also know that Robin vomiting after this will also be reported to him afterwards.
How dare you find the thought of him touching you repulsive?
I'm kind of really sad that she threw up because, you know, she needed those calories.
I know, and it was good food.
Jonathan Wace is the reason why we can't have nice things.
And the one nice meal she'd had in 4 months was sexual assault.
Oh, boy. All right. We need a cult chapter cleanse.
Yes, we do.
Yes. Anybody have one?
I've been thinking about their wedding lately.
Oh,
because you were talking about maybe it taking place in St. Mons, right?
Kurt was saying that.
I think these two would get married in London. And you know what? I see a bunch of people say that, you know, they go to the registry office one day. It'd be very low-key. Just get married, surprise everyone. But I was thinking lately that, you know what? I think that Strike would actually push for having an actual wedding. I think he would surprise everyone because he seems like the kind of registry office get it done guy. No, I think he'd want to celebrate. I think after barging in on her wedding and having to witness her and Matthew, he'd want to be the one standing at the top of the aisle watching her walk up to him. He'd want to be the one dancing with her. He'd want to be the one making the speech about her.
I can see this.
Right?
Yeah.
And yeah, they'd still keep it low key. They'd still keep it small and just the people they love, not extravagant or ridiculous. I'm picturing St. Giles in the Field Church that's right next to the office. And I'm picturing renting out the basement room at the Flying Horse for 30 people, having like a morning wedding, a lunch buffet, a couple drinks, and then they go for fucking vacation for once, right?
A fucking vacation.
Yeah. I can picture Robin's dress. Gorgeous. You know that dress in Atonement, Ken's?
Yes.
The green one. So I'm picturing that fabric, that skirt. It's just the top is a bit more covered up with little thicker straps, actually not showing her boobs because she's got too much for that Keira Knightley dress.
I do think that there are signs in the books that might hint to this.
Agreed.
The thing about wishing that she had a wedding day and honeymoon that was safe to look back on.
Yes.
Not that that couldn't be a registry office thing, but when Robin is so detached from her own wedding planning in Career of Evil, I feel like she might be more excited about this one.
She would be. I think they'd plan it together. I think they would both want to put the effort and the thought in to make a nice day that reflects who they are. And I think Robin would be like, are you sure you want this, Strike? And he'd be like, I want nothing more than to stand up in front of all of our friends and family and tell them how much I fucking love you. So get ready, girl, because my speech is going to be a banger. He wouldn't say it in those words. That's what Strike is me. But his speech would make me cry. I was imagining it in my head when I was like trying to go to sleep last night. You know, my brain stories.
As you do.
As one does. And it was really good. Pat would volunteer to make their cake. She'd make a traditional fruit cake and, and like tear it and decorate it for them.
Oh, the whole nine yards. Obviously. And the photographer is going to think that he's never seen a couple that's looked happier to be marrying each other.
And they'd walk from the church to the pub because it's a 5-minute walk and they'd pass their office. And I figure they've by this time had to move out of the office, but maybe they take a picture holding
in front
each other
of the door.
In front of the door.
That's very sweet.
Oh, my soul feels cleansed imagining this day for them.
Mm.
Elsa would be over the goddamn moon.
The fact that Robin doesn't smile at all during her wedding day to Matthew.
Yeah.
I could see a contrast being where she can't stop smiling.
She can't stop smiling. Anyway, that's
That's very sweet.
I feel cleansed.
Okay, let's go to chapter 74.
All right, chapter 74. In this chapter, Robin witnesses Barkley removing her letters from the rock. And then the epigraph for this chapter. Nine at the top means perseverance brings the woman into danger. The moon is nearly full. And that is from Hexagram 9, the taming power of the small.
I think this is saying that Robin deciding to stay in this chapter is going to bring her to danger. And the moon is nearly full means we're almost there.
100%. Absolutely. The judgment for this line backs you up saying, success is at hand. This has come about through the accumulation of small effects, but a success thus secured bit by bit calls for great caution. It would be a dangerous illusion for anyone to think he could presume upon it. The female principle, the weak element that has won the victory, should never persist in vaunting it, which would lead to danger. The dark power in the moon is strongest when the moon is almost full. So yes, this is saying Robin is so close to victory, but she is in so much danger. She needs to be cautious. She needs to be careful. The power of the cult is about to reach its zenith.
I don't know how she slept for the remaining time she's there. How did she ever close her eyes and sleep? She probably did not sleep well at all because she's always...
Well, the one night she doesn't.
No, I know, but you know what I mean? Like, how do you sleep in the dorms? They could come for her at any time, you know?
Yeah, I couldn't. Oh my God.
I bet she slept so well the night next to Strike when she actually felt safe for the first time in 4 months.
Oh my God. Okay.
Yep. Because he was next to her.
Yep.
It's fine. We're fine.
So this is a really short chapter.
Yeah.
And it starts off with talking about how Robin is now feeling a constant fear in a way that she hadn't yet felt at the farm. And it says that she is also now under constant surveillance, even in the bathroom. So clearly Mark 3.
Yeah.
And it says that it took more courage than ever before for Robin to leave her bed on Thursday night to write to Strike. My only thought is it's Strike that gets her up. You know, okay. Through all that fear is the thought of Strike
that gets her out of that bed.
Oh, cool. Oh, my God.
We are like in the emotions closet for real.
Deep, deep.
Mm-hmm. We're in it.
6 feet under.
Yeah. So she has two letters, one from Strike and one from Murphy. Told her he was off to San Sebastian for 2 weeks. And while he'd written affectionately, she noted the undertone of displeasure that she wouldn't be going with him. Again, I really want to know exactly what it said.
Same. I need to analyze the words.
Me too. Mm-hmm. How does one actually put that much displeasure for it to come through into a note, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if this is ever more annoying than reading this right after what she's just gone through with Wace.
Right.
It's just shut up, dude.
Mm-hmm.
Don't be mad that she's not going. She was just sexually assaulted.
Where is the worry from him? He feels displeasure, but not fear. He does not have anxiety about whether she's okay, whether maybe she might need a police assist to escape from this cult. He's just like, oh, she's ruined my vacation. I want to have it. Yeah.
Ugh. Fucking prick, Murphy.
TPM.
Yep.
THM. PHP.
I'm sorry, what?
Are you having a stroke?
Yes, possibly. Moving on.
The rest of the chapter really is just about her thinking about leaving, deciding to stay, and then seeing Barkley. Yeah.
At this point, I wanted her to leave more than I ever had before. But I knew that Barkley was not going to be the one to take her away. I knew this was going to have to be Strike. I mean, come on, it has to be Strike.
Mm-hmm. It does. Yes. You know, as much as I love Sam, as much as I love their friendship and their little grave-digging buddy partnership, you know that's close to my heart. There was only ever one man who's coming to give Robin a ride away from this hellhole.
Yes. Even later, when they're talking about picking Robin up, but Strike is headed out to interview Cherie, so he's disappointed that he wasn't going to get to do it. I knew that wasn't happening. I knew he was turning around. There was no way it was not going to be Strike.
Exactly. Yeah.
It doesn't make it any less painful, though, when she's watching Barkley and thinking about calling out to him but remaining silent. Mm. I had initially wondered why she hadn't gone to talk to him, even if she was still going to stay, but I don't think that she could have done it.
No.
If she had the chance to actually tell him everything, he would have insisted that she leave with him.
Yeah.
I don't think she'd be able to resist either.
Agreed. Even Barkley just seeing the state of her, so thin and exhausted and terrified, he'd have dragged her out and over that wall.
I love the line that says, separated from her colleague by only 10 yards, she felt like a ghost who had no business conversing with the living.
Aww.
It's a great image on its own of how Robin must be feeling. But it's also interesting when you contrast it with the whole idea of the drowned prophet, who's supposed to be this ghost watching and interacting and interfering with the living in a horrifying way.
It's like the cult is a disease. As Robin says, it turns an infectious agent that turns its cult members into its own illness. If you stay under the eyes of the chick from the ring too long, you become the chick from the ring. You become the ghost under the eye of the ghost.
I see.
That's how it works.
She's about to re-enter the land of the living, though.
Oh, I can't wait.
We're getting so close.
We are so close. And the rest of this book is going to be so much fun going through it. Oh, it's going to be. There's so many good parts.
Yeah.
I know.
Oh, I can't wait. I might go read ahead tonight just to recover from this.
Should we go get into our partner's chat?
Yeah, partner's chat, baby.
Okay. We had a question sent in for this segment from Laura, Dave, and the girls on Instagram.
Laura, Dave, and the girls.
Yeah. I don't know if it's Laura or Dave or the girls.
How many girls?
We don't know.
Thank you to all of you.
So the question is, if someone made an action figure of you, which two accessories would come with it?
Mm.
Same question for Strike and Robin as well.
Ooh, fun.
This is a really, really fun question.
I like that.
I think that for both of them, their phones would probably be an absolute must, right? Since so much of their work revolves around like taking pictures of people and videos and stuff.
Yeah.
I feel like Strike would probably have his vape in his other hand.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Robin's a little more difficult for me as to pin down as far as like a second accessory. Maybe a small brass frog, you know, because after all, if you have a small brass frog, that means you're armed.
It does. Yes.
That's a weapon.
What about for you?
And then for me, probably my iPad, because I use it for pretty much everything. Mm-hmm. And then my purple water bottle, because both of these are attached at my hip at pretty much all times.
Nice. What about you, Pools?
Okay. So for myself, my first accessory would have to be the Diet Coke. Just a bottle can
I understand.
Diet Coke permanently attached to my hand. What else my other accessory be? I think I'd have my little cat, my little Robins, a little cat accessory. Maybe she could like sit on my shoulder, or like you could, I don't know, attach her to the leg or something.
Like across the shoulders.
Yeah, like a shoulder cat. She would never do that. Literally never. I'd probably bleed out trying to get her to do that.
She'd cut an artery.
She does not like being picked up or held. Like she needs to be in control of any interaction. So that would not go great, but it would be really cute as a little accessory. Those would be my accessories. Oh, maybe like a little pack of tarot cards would be a cool accessory just to annoy Lindsay.
Yeah.
Not because I even use them that much.
If you buy your action figures together, you can interact and be like, this is stupid.
That would be so fun. I like that.
Do you want to know your star sign? No. And I run away.
If you really want to free up your hands, you can get one of those, you know, those backpacks that like bikers wear and shit to be able to drink while they're filled that with Diet Coke.
Little Diet Coke backpack.
Oh, I was thinking the kind of cat carriers that have the cat in
can
the
we
backpack.
Combine the two?
No, that would be really disgusting Diet Coke.
Well, I mean, different compartments. The cat's not sitting in the Diet Coke.
That would not be sanitary. That would not be good.
That would be very bad.
That if you have it attached to your back, see, then you have room for one other thing in your hand, which I think should be a thing of tinfoil. Because if there was ever anything that was on brand.
No. Nice, Ken.
Accessory. Yes. Nice. I've already made it into a hat.
Oh,
it goes on my head,
there
Ken's.
You go. There you go.
Although you're putting it the weight on your back to have your hands free, I instantly thought, oh, did Tolstoy say that?
Yeah. Advice.
All right, yes. Tinfoil hat, backpack of Diet Coke, arm cat.
Yeah.
For Strike and Robin.
Yes.
Strike, Ken's, I gotta go with the vape pen too, because it's so good. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so good. Maybe we could do like a high-tech action figure where like you press the tiny button and
smoke
a little
comes
smoke
out.
Comes out of the vape pen somehow.
Love it.
Like a little steam pen. That'd be really cute.
Yeah.
Another accessory. Oh, you know what I would like? A little snap-on, snap-off beard.
Yes. Oh my God, yes.
So you can,
when
like,
he goes to court.
Snap-on beard, snap-off beard.
I love
you know,
it.
Does Robin like the beard? I pull her a little talkie cord to find out, you know. Yeah. That would be really cute.
Yeah, I like that.
For Robin, oh, the brass frog is so cute. I would give Robin, obviously, a shovel for digging up the graves, right? And then she'd have to come with a Barkley accessory, and he would also have a shovel. And then you team them up like they're Power Rangers, and they become a Megazord. They somehow become something else when you combine them with their shovels. I don't know what they would turn into. A car? No. That's Transformers.
That is, yeah.
Robin would totally work as like a car transformer, though, if you could somehow have her head transform every so like she becomes sitting in a car.
Oh,
I don't
God.
Know how that would work.
She becomes the car.
Kind of
she becomes Landy.
It's like a horror movie version of Cars.
Okay, for me, I have to take your idea, Pools, but mine would be a Cherry Coke Zero. Just always with me.
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah, and maybe my kids. Because those two, always with me. Maybe, I don't know, are they sold separately? They're separate action figures? I don't know.
Or do you become a Megazord?
I don't with my children. They go back into my body.
They become like a Godzilla figure.
She becomes one of those bosses from video games where it's like one mega boss and then they've got like two little minions and you have to defeat the minions before you can actually do any damage.
Yeah. Wow. That sounds accurate. Jack would make a good video game boss, though.
He is into the villains.
He's going places.
He would embrace it.
I think for Strike, instead of his vape, I'm going to say his notepad, because you know how much when he takes out his notepad.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I love your idea about a detachable beard. So I'm going to say detachable heart eyes for when he looks at the Robin action figure.
Oh, that's so cute. Yeah.
Literal hearts.
Little hearts over his eyes. That's really cute. Yeah.
And like Robin... that. Robin has to come with disguises. You know, she'll have the camera glasses and a wig so you can change her look. Maybe she'll be one of those dolls where, you know, when you put hot water or something on the face, makeup appears.
Oh,
do
yeah.
you remember those kinds?
Yeah, I remember those.
Yeah.
You can do that with her so that her look changes.
Oh.
Cold water is one look and hot water is another look.
That would be fun. And you could do it so like the eye pigment changes too.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Like contacts. Yeah. I like that. That's a neat
very
idea.
Nice. She's got to come with disguises, right? That's Robin's thing.
That's genius.
Totally. Yeah.
That's good. Oh, that was a fun question.
That is a fun question.
I really want a detachable beard Strike action figure now.
You could do that with the water too. Make the beard appear and disappear with hot and cold water.
Smart. Oh, there you go.
Okay, here's a question for Strikes. Does it have the chest hair? Because it has to.
Yes.
Obviously.
Yes, of course.
In other news, how is everyone doing on the London Challenge? Because guess what?
What?
I finished it.
You finished it.
I finished
it. You did.
Isn't that amazing?
Everybody gave a round of applause.
I did it.
You thought you wouldn't do it, and you did it.
I thought I wouldn't do it. I thought I would fail. I did not fail. I did the whole thing.
And you're going to get a medal.
I know. I'm excited. It's already on its way.
Nice.
But no, it's good. Kenz, have you finished it too, right?
I did. Not too long ago. Got the medal and everything.
Round of applause for Pool. It's not me. It's Kenz. Kenz.
Get still round applause. Of applause for Pool. Well, so we can do another one.
More for me. So I started the Shire with one other person. I'd love for more people to join me on the trip to Mordor, because I think I'm in that for the long haul. But we should also decide on another big group one for after London.
I agree.
Because I'm going to do that simultaneously.
We'll take a look at that and decide what one we're going to do next and let everyone know.
I mean, the exercise feels good, annoyingly.
All right. Mm. That was a fun partners chat, wasn't it?
It was.
What are we doing next time, kids?
All right, so next time we are doing chapters 75 through 77. In these chapters, Strike discovers the real reason for Little John's weird behavior, and Robin finds a way to get Will alone and talk to him about his belief in the UHC.
Oh, God.
Those are going to be some interesting chapters to talk about.
Yeah, I can't wait. I got to prepare my cleanse topics ahead of time, like a smoothie.
Do we need a cleanse one for after the Will naked?
Oh, yeah. I need some bleach brain.
I actually feel quite bad for him about that. That's horribly embarrassing.
It's deeply embarrassing. And also very, very awful for Robin to experience.
Oh, horrifying.
I'm going to need to cleanse my brain.
We can cleanse ourselves. Yeah. We can come up with something.
We will find something cute.
I think we will manage to find something cute about Strike and Robin to talk about.
That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.